Ho ho ho, and welcome to this festive edition of Towards the Point, a cultural compass for Pompey and beyond. I'm James Sandy, and tonight we consider Yuletime song and film, and the notion of a Black Christmas, reflect on the outsider in a new exhibition of art, and we also chat with Boo Hooideen and Brooks Williams as they stop off on their State of the Union tour. There's also a few Christmas time events to consider over your winter port, and some messages from our friends. As ever, I'm joined by Simon Mobbs and Dave Allen.
Hello.
Hello.
Here they are. They've made it through the snow stroke rain, depending on the season. And we're going to start the programme tonight with art. And Simon, you're bringing us some outside and curious things.
Yeah. There's an exhibition taking place in Chichester at the Pallant House Gallery called Outside In, which is dedicated to outsider art. Maybe it's best to give a brief definition of what outsider art consists of.
I'm baffled already by that. Is that people outside in the street, or is it, you know, kind of
Sunday painters, you know, outside
chalk on pavement, or what?
Sort of.
How's it defined?
It's artists who exist outside the boundaries of mainstream art culture or mainstream society. Even sometimes the artists may have mental health issues. They may, you know, it might be people that are younger. It initially comes from the term art brut, which was defined by the French artist Dubuffet, and it meant kind of raw art or rough art. It's by people who are not necessarily schooled in art in the traditional sense.
So does brute mean strength, doesn't it, I think?
Yeah, and I think he felt that there was a strength to it as well. In the English kind of term of outsider art, it's maybe a little bit more broad. So it could be artists who are self-taught. It could be sort of naive in style. Non-institutionalised, I think, is a way to look at it. People who haven't learnt about perspective or colour theory or composition or these kind of things, but are actually going ahead and producing art. Quite often it's got themes of like being about mental states or unconventional ideas in it, possibly fantasy worlds. I think the allure of it is it's quite often considered like pure or unrefined or sort of uninformed, unpretentious in a way. It's not necessarily made with an audience in mind initially. It's quite personal work. A lot of artists who have been through the system talk about unlearning and sort of like wanting to kind of almost go back to a more kind of childlike way of producing work.
Deconstruct.
Yeah. And I think part of the allure of outsider art is that they don't need to do that because they haven't been through the system already.
So it's described, I read some of the kind of synopsis online, and it's described as kind of artists from outside the margins.
Mm.
But my question is, what are the margins? Who defines the margins? You know, kind of, you know, there's also, I'm going to throw lots of questions at you, there's also a question about, is it mainstream or non-mainstream if it's in a mainstream gallery?
Oh, yeah.
You know, does it become something that it's actually trying not to be?
Yeah,
if you see what I mean. Dave, what do you think about this? Maybe you can throw some light on it for us.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you a comparison that I would make that I think is kind of interesting, because I'll do this often in the arts, which is to think about professional musicians. Mm. Now, in the world of professional musicians, we differentiate between people who are second cellists in the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra and the bloke who plays lead guitar down at the Eastney Cellars.
Indeed.
But you know, you interview people who in a sense are outsider musicians because they haven't been through the Royal College of Music and so on and so on. They're pretty big guys. They've made albums, and we don't think anything of that. We're not troubled by that. And you know, if they act in somewhat eccentric and somewhat crazy ways, we just think, yeah, that's rock and roll, yeah, groovy, you know. And it's interesting that when you shift back into visual art, that we do make that massive distinction between people who've, and I think increasingly actually, between people who've done A-level and then done foundation and then done fine art and then been picked up by a gallery in London and the stuff sold. And, I mean, the obvious example is the young British artists, you know, Damien Hirst and Tracy Emin and so on, who 20 years ago or whatever, were picked up in that way, even though it was pretty extreme stuff that people weren't used to. And it is in its own way now entirely mainstream. You know, the odd thing is that landscape painting is no longer mainstream. It's almost outsider now. You know, we're a stuff in a shark and shoving it in a gallery is. So, you know, I think you ask very important questions. And
well, I try.
Yeah. And whether that work is changed by being put in a gallery, given a catalogue, you know, and then you walk into the next gallery, you know, and there's Peter Blake and you know, pop art and stuff, and downstairs there's 18th century landscape, you know. Does that change it? Great question.
Is there? I'm going to throw another great question out here. Now, do you think there's something about this where, from certainly building on what you just said, Dave, there's something about the kind of the accepted amateur almost, isn't there? Or kind of almost the professional amateur, which is a contradiction.
If I could just say, maybe linking it back to music. I mean, there's a phrase in punk music which is, "Here's a chord, here's another chord, here's a third chord. Now form a band." That's and right. It's like, you know, you don't need to be schooled in the most perfect way to then kind of give it a go. The importance is the energy you go about with it, and you just, the DIY ethic of just giving it a go. You know, the same thing could be said, for example, punk fanzines, for example. Here's a typewriter, here's a photocopier, now form a magazine. You know, it's that kind of, and this, it's a similar thing within this art exhibition. It's, you might not have been to, you know, university, you might not have been to college, night school, or whatever, to kind of do the art courses, but you're giving it a go. It's a form of self-expression. It's something you can get something from.
The other thing that struck me about it, Simon, I mean, it's a while since I went around it. There's almost a parallel between it and the Paralympics, in that there is a quite strong element of disability implied or actual in that show, whereas there is another huge generation of people out there who are, if you like, Sunday afternoon painters. You know, we've got ordinary, bus conductors, train drivers, dockyard workers, and then on a Sunday afternoon, they like to paint. In fact, I've taught people like that in evening classes in the past. Those sorts of artists are not really in this show, are they?
No,
it's a more challenging show than that.
Well, tell us about the kind of format of the exhibition, how it's organised.
So the Outside In organisation is basically an agency, an arts agency, which likes to provide a platform for artists who find it difficult to access the art world. As we were saying before, it might be through mental health, disability, health reasons, social reasons. But for whatever reason, they can't access the kind of the education or the kind of formats that would normally be available. I think there's a quote here is that Outside In can function as a mouthpiece to project the voices of quieter people. And it offers a community for these people. It offers opportunities to have an online presence with your work, a chance to take part in national competitions, and also info and advice about how to kind of get started within, you know, producing your work and getting it seen by people. So I quite like that idea about being for people who might otherwise have fallen underneath the radar. Moving through then, so the actual exhibition itself, it's lots of entries have been put in, and they've essentially chosen the best ones, the ones that they think will work best in the exhibition space, and then they themed it into three different rooms. So you've got one room on intuition, one room on introspection, and one room on insight. What's interesting as well is then after that you've also got a room dedicated to Jean Dubuffet, who is also, as we were talking earlier, the guy who actually kind of termed the art brute format. But I think what's interesting with him is he is very much somebody who I would argue is more of a kind of educated artist who then gives the outsider art brute style a go.
So let's move then on to some of the work and some of the pieces actually in the exhibition. You talked about the kind of three rooms and the kind of three different themes. I haven't had a chance to get along and look at the exhibition, but there is a piece called Soulmates, which I looked at on the website, which for me reminded me very much of, there's a cartoonist, Robert Crumb. I think you've come across Robert Crumb, who does all kinds of rather crude, but artistic, shall we say, drawings. And one of the pieces really reminded me of that, where you've got kind of two figures, one with a skull, kind of embracing, perhaps a little bit too intimately, shall we say, on a very confused background. But there's lots of interesting, kind of almost cartoon-like work in there, isn't there, I think?
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely an exhibition of contrasts, I would say. I think the pieces that particularly struck me were ones that were quite childlike, quite joyful, quite colourful, almost naive in their sort of self-expression. But then you've also got, like you say, some ones that's quite dark, quite troubled. They're dealing with things like depression, anxiety, bipolar. Quite often there's imagery of a violent or sexual nature in it. And it kind of jumps between, say, the first room labelled intuition is very spontaneous, very colourful, liberating kind of room. And then the second room, introspection, has got these much more obsessive, compulsive, almost kind of cathartic images that are sometimes quite difficult to look at.
There's an important point. In the last show that we did, we were talking about the current show at the Aspects Gallery, which is very hard edge, very formal, geometric, abstract. And I wouldn't ever claim that that work does not in some complex way express things about the man who's made it, but it's not obvious what that is. Whereas sometimes with the work in Chichester, you've got people who are on a daily basis troubled by real issues in their life of all kinds, and they use the medium of their art practice to express and explore some of, and hopefully, you know, one hopes that that helps them to transform themselves. I think that's a complex question, but that's clearly, you know, it's in that sense kind of issue-based art, expressive, personally expressive.
And I think the backstories, because you often have a bit of information by the pictures, and when you
that always helps me, because, you know, I'm only lightly educated, as Frankie Howard once said.
And, you know, what the artist is hoping to get from art, what their situation is, that does add something to the images as well. I think something that I got from it was some of them just had a kind of amazing craftsmanship to them. They just really kind of laboured over these pieces. And there was a particular piece called The Hole by an artist called Quay Eden, which was, you know, it was a huge, big, abstract piece. It was, you know, almost as tall as, you know, you know yourself or myself. And it was, I believe it's wax crayon that has been, you know, very forcefully kind of put onto these thick pieces of cartridge paper to make a kind of textile-like pattern.
I would describe it, having just looked at it very briefly, I would describe it as looking like a kind of an oil slick in Crayola.
Yeah.
Or, you know, it kind of... Tree rings is the other thing that kind of springs to mind.
Tree rings giving a sort of psychedelic kind of
over.
It reminds me of like going to a science museum and when you see, like, you know, rocks that have been cut in half and you've got these amazing things going on inside. Very geological looking, but just the amount of hours that must have gone into that and the impact when you see it.
There's an interesting point also about the Dubuffet, in which you've already made the point that he had, in a sense, a mainstream education and, you know, was, you know, in quotes, a proper artist, but actually shifted towards this. And that's happening quite a lot in the middle of the 20th century, or in fact, even earlier. So as soon as, you know, the high priests of modernism, like Picasso gets very excited about discovering something that in those days was called primitive art from Africa, for instance. Now, we have to be very cautious about those terms these days, but, you know, 100 years ago he was doing that to liberate himself from the kind of academic style that he was being brought up in. And, you know, if you shift forward about 30 years, you find the colony of major British artists who go off to St. Ives, you know, Ben Nicholson and Barbara Hepworth and so on, and they discover this old sailor called Alfred Wallace, you know, and they discover these extraordinary paintings that he does on scrappy old bits of driftwood, which kind of break with all the conventions of perspective and everything. They see that work as a way of liberating themselves and moving forward, you know. And I mean, I suppose The point I'm making about this is that, and I may not have paid enough attention at Chichester, but I'm not clear about whether what we're seeing at Chichester is likely to have the same impact as Wallace had on Nicholson, or, you know, those other artists had on Dubuffet. You know, is it, for instance, a way out of what seems to me increasingly the cul-de-sac of what we call conceptualism? You know, that actually, when I see fresh conceptualism these days, I think, it's kind of been done, mate, actually. You know, where are we going? You know,
there's also something quite primitive or primordial in some of the images in the exhibition, but there's also, I think, a good dollop of sarcasm about some of the works. There is, for example, a kind of classic portrait picture, but it's actually got two balloons instead of a head. Obviously, the artist in question is probably trying to be challenging in some way, but also I kind of think, well, actually, is this outside art actually about mocking art itself?
Yeah, and I found the third room, which is labelled insight, a bit more knowing, and it was quite often the artists were using their circumstances as a starting point, and it was almost like outside art, but from a more social political point of view. So they're raising awareness of things such as anxiety, depression, bipolar. There was particularly one piece which was, for example, a pill, which was had like is a sculpture, and one side of it was actually a smiley face, a happy face, and one was a sad face. And it was I think the idea is that the pill is quite life size, rotate, that kind of thing, to show the difference that taking this drug could take on them. I presume it was a prescribed drug.
Comedy and tragedy, those are themes that have hardly been touched in art, I think, or music.
And it's, I suppose you could kind of link it in with sort of feminist art or disability arts or those kind of terms as well, particularly that third room.
You've told us some of your observations of the exhibition. Is it an exhibition that you would recommend people to go to? Is it something that you felt satisfied with? I know I ask you these questions every time you go off and find some of these wonderful things, but is it something you're comfortable with? Is it something to recommend?
I think if you go into it with a view of it being a group show, and there's lots and lots of artists presented in here, and it's a real mixed bag. And there's, like, as we said before, it's a very varied kind of show in terms of the content. So some of it you'll probably really like, and some of it you'll probably dislike or find quite uncomfortable. But I certainly picked out quite a few pieces that I was bowled over by, certainly. And I think part of the irony I found about the term outsider art is that there's something almost more approachable about this kind of art, because sometimes kind of high fine art is kind of more conceptual and more difficult to kind of get into, whereas this, there is maybe more about the craftsmanship. It was a bit more direct, and people could literally see, okay, that has taken a lot of hours to produce. I can see the kind of the pure craftsmanship in that. So in some ways, it's maybe more approachable than some sort of modern art exhibitions on more recently.
We've thrown up some big critical questions, I think, but we're allowed to do that as a kind of cultural review programme. If people want to try and work out answers for themselves, just tell us where they have to go and how long the exhibition's on for.
Outsider in the National 2012 is on at Pallant House Gallery until the 3rd of February 2013.
Hi, I'm Rob from Pie and Vinyl, and my favourite Christmas film is The Gremlins. The reason being is I loved it when Billy's dad brought home the Mogwai, and being a small kid at the time, I always thought, I want one of those for Christmas, I want my dad to bring me home a Mogwai for Christmas. But hey, there's a lesson in that, kids, because cute little things don't always turn out to be great things, and I also learned that from The Gremlins, but I still want a Mogwai. Merry Christmas.
I'm Steve from Pie and Vinyl. My favourite Christmas track is 2,000 Miles by The Pretenders. Don't have a great deal of reason why, just a great song. Not one of those usual tracks that people choose, like Fairy Tale of New York or Slade. But just reminds me of Christmas growing up, and a roaring fire, my dad having a few beers, my mum getting stressed, 2,000 Miles in the background. So that's why.
Remember, records are for life and not just for Christmas.
Thank you for supporting us over the past few months. Have a great Christmas, and generally just be excellent to each other.
Hi, this is Steve Pitt. I'm the programmer of the Sellers at Eastney in Portsmouth and chair of the Culture Partnership. My favourite Christmas track would be Jonah Louie's Stop the Cavalry from 1980, and my favourite Christmas film would be It's a Wonderful Life with James Stewart. I'd like to wish everybody a big Merry Christmas for all your support this year. It's been truly wonderful to see so many people out at live events, and we look forward to you engaging with a brilliant programme in the new year. Just have a good Christmas.
We move now to music. And earlier on this month, I got the chance to interview Boo Hewideen and Brooks Williams and ask them about their special relationship that resulted in the album State of the Union.
I'm very pleased to be here with Boo Hewideen and Brooks Williams. Welcome.
Hello.
And it's great to be hiding out in the Cellars, and a place you've played before, I think, Boo?
I've played here many times, and I like it very much. In fact, there's a picture of me on the wall.
There is.
Where it says underneath it, it says, I'm so sorry. I can't remember what I did.
But you've repented for it.
I have repented, but this is Brooks's first time, I believe.
Right. This is my first time, so...
We'll be gentle on you.
Yeah, thank you very much. Go easy.
At the moment, you're touring State of the Union, which is an album that came out in April of this year, an album I love, I have to say, and I'm not just saying that because you're here, I really do love the album. I'm really keen to find out its origins, where it came from, because there is a kind of Christmas link, I think, isn't there, to how it came about?
Well, there is, because every year, where I live in Ely, I do a Christmas concert, and 2 years ago, when we had the terrible snows, my two special guests, who were... Chris Difford from Squeeze and Barry McGuigan, the boxer, who's going to come and sing some songs, couldn't get through the snows. Now, I have met Brooks before because he interviewed me for a guitar magazine, which is a bit like Christopher Wren interviewing Bob the Builder, because he's very good at the guitar. So, I knew about him, and I was panicking on the morning, and I suddenly thought, oh, Brooks lives up the road, so he can make it. So he came along and taught him the set in about 40 minutes, and that was it, really.
Yeah,
wasn't it?
That was it. That's where it started.
And then we thought we'd do something together. At first, we were just going to do a couple of gigs. We did a couple more gigs and thought, well, let's make a little EP. And then we thought, well, come on, let's be an act.
Yeah.
And it's great because we live near each other. And for me, most people I work with live in Scotland or Ireland or whatever. And And do you work with other people sometimes?
Yeah, I do sometimes.
But you don't like it as much as working with
people? No, I don't. I don't. There's no one that compares.
Mm. So when that came about, was there a natural chemistry straight away, or was it sort of... did you come to the songs first, or...?
Yeah, it was songs first, I would say. It was just, here's a song, it goes like this, and it just... Yeah, it just kind of felt right. It was almost like...
It was great because I think the second show we did, which was it's quite a big gig in a church, where we both did a spot, and I asked Bruce to come and play with me. I would sort of whisper him the chords before I did the song, and then we'd play the song, and at the end he'd come over and go, that's a good song, that, which is quite a nice thing, because he'd never heard it until he played it in front of an audience.
Yeah. And was it difficult to get the kind of the styles matched, or because you've both done a variety of different things, so I imagine it was kind of, was it just sort of finding the same groove, as it were?
I think that was the thing that struck me first off, was that our approach to the songs, rhythmically, harmonically, just the vibe, the groove of it was just slotted in. It was almost like you know we were kind of thinking the same way in some ways,
which is nice because we come from such different backgrounds.
Yeah,
I was in indie bands and stuff, and Brooks, you know, in Georgia and Boston. And but somehow when we play together, for me, and I think for Brooks as well, one of the big things when I'm playing with someone who's having a good sense of time. And that's not something you always come across, and I think that's why we started enjoying it.
Let's talk about the songs, because there's some great songs on the album, and obviously hopefully you're going to play most of them or all of them this evening. I'm looking forward to that. I was saying to you earlier that I came to the album by 23 Skidoo, that track, which is a great song, I think, sort of built on a kind of almost a sort of throwaway approach to life in some ways, in that you know, anything might happen, so you might as well just get on with it. But there's a real ragtime feel to it as well.
Exactly. Well, 23 Skidoo means is a jazz expression for let's get out of here. And the melody actually started, the guy who produced our album, is a man called Mark Freegard, and when he's not, and I do a lot of producing with him, and when he's not producing, he'll suddenly pick up his ukulele, which is there, and he starts playing little tunes, and the first three notes are his. And then he went off somewhere I didn't like where he went. So I took his first three notes and then turned it into that tune. So he gets a credit for three notes. He's a lucky man.
He is.
They're an important three notes. I think
they do.
I think when you first listen to the album, you're not quite clear how it's going to go, because you've got the first track, which is Darkness, which is quite a sort of broody, quite twangy guitar based track. Then you've got 23 Skidoo, which is quite a quirky, almost comic song in some ways. And then you move to quite an off the wall cover of Rent, the Pet Shop Boys song. Can you tell me why that sort of cropped out? I've seen you on YouTube saying we're doing this because we can. I think that's a good reason.
There's a State of the Union universe of song. If it fits in, it fits in, and we both instinctively know if it fits. And we wrote this record in my front room mostly, didn't we, when we had days off during the summer. And then I remember when I first had a record deal, the guy said you should always put a cover on your album. He's a guy called Nigel Grange, who used to do Rod Stewart, 10cc's and older. Listen to him. So I just said that to Brooks, and let's pick the strangest cover that we can.
I think it really works, and I think one thing it does for me personally is it picks out the fact that the album is kind of strangely out of era, but rooted in lots of sort of history. Do you know what I mean? It's a very modern record, but a very old record.
That's exactly the State of the Union thing, isn't it?
Well,
I'm pleased you said that, because we've talked about that.
I wanted to ask you about the kind of process of songwriting. I know, Boo, you're up to some songwriting masterclasses, I think, in January time.
Yeah, I do them quite a lot,
To sort of train up the next generation of...
It's always really good fun to do, and it's really nice when people then go on and make records, which happens quite often. And you do that as well. You do guitar versions of that.
Yeah, same idea, where I would work with songwriters who are looking... I mean, essentially we're talking about the music in the song, but you always end up going back to the lyrics as well. But it's how to take an idea of the song and sort of expand it and work on it, and to not be too precious about it, that it's meant to be sort of played with and reshaped and you know, that it's not necessarily something that was sent down from on high, that you have to hold, you know, sacrosanct and it's precious. You really should get in there and muscle it around.
That's really good. I was, well, like last night, I was telling you, I was watching that. I watched a documentary about Harry Nilsson, and it's a little part when he was younger and he was talking about songwriting. He was on a show and he says, "I want to talk about songwriting today because you've really got to understand your song. You've really got to be able to dismantle it and put it back together."
Again. Yeah. That's a great way to put it. Yeah,
because that's what we do, isn't it? Yeah. And it was great to see someone that good say that.
How the songwriting for this record worked for me typically would, I mean, there were many different ways, but from my perspective, what would happen is I would come to our sessions with an idea, and it may be fully formed. Mm. Like in the case of Darkness, it was a fully formed song, completely different melody, completely different everything. And we actually worked up a version of that song. But as we were playing it, it occurred to me that it wasn't a State of the Union song. And so I think I went away and we came back the next day and I came up with that sort of folky, dark riff. Hmm. And I had stripped the words out. I threw away half of the lyrics.
Yeah.
But I only did that because we were singing it and playing it the day before and we'd pause and go, "Oh, we should, maybe that should move here and that." So it was very much an active process. And then when I came back the next day, Boo said, "Well, let's look at Darkness again." And so I said, "Ooh, check this out." And I played the opening riff and he said, "That's it."
Yeah.
"That's it." That's, so it's, you know, very much in the moment.
And as a partnership, I mean, you mentioned, I think, with this record, you managed to complete it fairly quickly across a number of...
A day and a half.
Whether, is it easier these days to kind of do it separately and through distance and through technology?
Oh, we didn't actually use that. We actually used being in the room together.
Yeah.
I think both of us have written using the internet and stuff. But no, we always made it about being in the room together and kind of trying to impress each other.
Mm.
So there's an element of show and tell. There was an element of, there were a couple that are complete collaborations.
Yes.
And we've been doing that all this year, actually. We're going to make the next one next month, the next record.
Mm. And I'm very pleased to hear that. I'm very pleased to hear there's going to be a follow-on, a successor.
But for the first half of the set, we're playing most of those, and I think we've booted it up another level. We're really pleased with that because
I think so.
It's a great process because both of us make our own records and they're quite serious, which is great. But what's nice about when you do a State of the Union song is it just has to be good. And that Darkness is a really good thing because you've got some beautiful lyrics, and then when you stripped it down to like really simple, then it became really effective.
Yeah,
didn't it? That's something that both you and I probably wouldn't do by ourselves.
Now, Brooks, when I look at your online presence, your website, you're described as a fret monster, a musical treasure, mind blowing, and various other categories. I'm keen to know what's on your passport as a profession. I guess musician, but are those things helpful? Are those things helpful, or you know, do they kind of? How would you describe what you do?
Because I don't know. I mean, those things come and they get sort of plucked out of these long reviews, and you sort of find the two words that somebody somewhere thinks are kind of exciting or that are different. You know, I don't really know about all those. Those a fret monster. I like the feel of that. I'm not sure it's actually true. I don't think I'm frightening.
You should definitely get a T-shirt with that.
I think I should do. Yeah, but as much as I am spoken of as a guitar player, I really like songs.
Yeah.
So I mean, I love guitar, but if you ask me to just play guitar, I'd get really bored quickly because I love songs and I love writing songs. But I love writing songs in the tradition of sort of blues and jazz. I love that sort of traditional form, if you will. Mm. And so I wish more blues players wrote in this form. I mean, and wrote contemporary blues lyrics. Like, don't just trot out the old 1930s lyrics, but write something that's current. Write something, you know, London, 2012. Write a blues song.
Mm.
But don't make it throwaway. Write a proper blues song that really gets to the heart of it. And, I mean, I really get into that. That being said, once the song is done, having a slide guitar or a lead riff or something, I really do like that.
You can't really complain because you're so good at playing the guitar. You know, that's why people say that.
Mm. Oh, well, thank you. Yeah. I mean,
Fret is monstrous.
It's monstrous.
I've never had Fret Monster. I think before I lost weight, I had Fat Monster. It's better than nothing.
Yeah.
Now, Bill, you mentioned obviously you both do different things individually. Your sort of newest album is God Bless the Pretty Things.
Yeah, it's a couple of years old.
Which is sort of your current album, I suppose.
I also work with a woman called Ellie Reader, who's just about to make another record. I work with another woman called Heidi Talbot, who just finished her album. And I work with Chris Difford from Squeeze. So I'm always making records, always doing things.
And your work with Eddie, I suppose, is probably... probably not fair to say, but one of the most famous things you did was Patience of Angels.
Well, it's the most successful thing, yeah. But we've made, we're just about to start, we're nowhere near as many as groups, we're just about to start our 10th album next month as well. We're doing that, in fact, I'm doing that just before we do ours. So.
It's really interesting to me where, you know, those kind of partnerships endure over time. You know, people go off and do different things.
Well, like, you know, I'm really happy that it's endured with her because she's been through lots of different partnerships, and I never take it for granted.
We are dangerously near to Christmas, as we know, and I'm very keen to ask people what their favourite Christmas tunes are. They can be things you've written, even, you know, composed. Have you got your favourite tracks that make you always think of Christmas?
Well, I heard Fairy Tale of New York in the car. It kind of does it every time.
That's quite good. I'm on a kind of an Elvis kick this year, so I'm really into
Presley.
Elvis Presley. Sorry. Is there another one?
Wow.
sorry.
Hotly contested.
So I'm into Blue Christmas this year, but I'm thinking of writing one because I come from Georgia. So, and
you come from Statesboro.
Statesboro,
is that right?
Georgia, yeah. And I mean, my relatives probably won't be tuning in to this, but there are some of my relatives who might be thought of as redneck. So I thought I'd write a song from that part of my background, and it's I'll Be Home for Christmas as Soon as I Get Out of Jail.
That'll resonate nicely.
I think it will do, or I can get chucked out of family.
We're nearly at the end of our time. You're touring State of the Union, a number of places across the UK. Hitchin Folk Club, you're doing, I think, on the 13th of January.
Yeah.
You're playing in Colchester on the 14th of January. And you're also playing in Thames Ditton on the 1st of February.
That's a great gig, you know.
That's a great,
you're doing a number of folk clubs, is that right?
That's the Ram Club, and for me, that's you've done the Ram
Club. I've done many, many times,
but it's a very, very important place to me because that was the very, very first solo gig I ever did. And someone got me the gig, and I arrived there. They've moved now, and it was like a shed at the back of a pub.
I sat there
and I got really early because I was used to being in a rock band, so I got there like 2 in the afternoon. Of course, no one turns up till 7. And I sat there and I thought, oh, this is going to be the worst night of my life. And then the people came, they set up, made the shed look lovely, the doors opened, the room was full, and I did my gig, and I got paid more than I'd ever been paid in my life before. I love that club.
Yes.
So don't say anything bad about that club.
That's a lovely memory, isn't it, on which to finish. Boo Brooks, thanks very much for talking to me. I'm really looking forward to the show later on, and I'm really looking forward to the second album as well.
Great,
so
thank you.
Thanks for your time.
Thank you very much.
Cheers.
Then the angels come for you, 23 skidoo. In the castle there's a king, thinks that he knows everything. There ain't nothing he can do about 23 skidoo. You can spend a lifetime learning right from wrong. Then you get it figured, and it's time that you were gone. Now I think I understand, we are in the promised land. The reason that I know it's true 23 Skidoo. Spend a lifetime learning right from wrong. Then you get it figured, and it's time that you were gone. All the women, all the men, all you get's 70 So when the angels come for you, say 23 Skidoo.
You can find out more information on the artists and the album at stateoftheunionmusic.com. We move now to the festive Yuletide Christmas experience. I'll give you a big build up there, Dave.
Thank you very much. We do indeed. Yeah,
well, we do.
So we should. What I'm going to do is to start by suggesting that all of us experience two kinds of Christmases in a very simple sense. One is the very particular Christmas of our family and the people we share it with, and the live events that we get involved in. The office party, the family Christmas lunch, the carol services we go to, and so on. And those are all things that we live through in if you like, the real world. Mm-hmm. And that there is a second one that the vast majority of us also live with, which is what I'm going to call the mediated Christmas, by which I simply mean everything that comes to us through publications, radio, cinema, television, and so on, which we share in a much more collective way. And of course, 30 or 40 years ago, we shared it in a very collective way, you know, where it was the done thing for everybody to sit down after Christmas dinner and watch Her Majesty, and then at about 7:30 to sit down and watch Eric and Ernie and their Christmas special, and so on. And it's a bit more dispersed than that now, but that's my idea, and we're going to look at the second one of those. And I wanted to start with something that I'm guessing, you know, everybody who's listening has some experience of, which is the music that's been used in some of the Christmas adverts this year.
I can already smell the chestnuts roasting.
Actually, I haven't spotted that one. I don't think has been used this year, although I may be wrong. But certainly, for example, there's Rod Stewart singing Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas, which first appeared in the 1940s, sung by Judy Garland in Meet Me in St. Louis. And that's a useful song to start with, because it's one of the key points about Christmas music, which is that there was a huge upsurge in the popularity of American Christmas popular music in the 1940s, and it starts with White Christmas, and then Bing Crosby releases the next year I'll Be Home for Christmas, in which he sings But If Only in My Dreams, and Judy Garland sings Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas next year, All Our Troubles Will Be Far Away. And of course, in the 1940s, what people are doing is becoming intensely nostalgic, because at that point, their boys are in the Far East or Europe fighting, and many of them are dying, and they're not coming back, and the troubles, and, you know, so there's a huge nostalgia market at that time, which builds up.
So there's something there, I think, about how kind of Christmas becomes that kind of chocolate box image, isn't it? You know, because it is very much, I suppose, in the period you were just talking about, it's almost a kind of morale-boosting exercise,
right,
isn't it?
It absolutely is. And, of course, what interests and excites me about it, in fact, is that there is a dark side to that. Because I think the most obvious example, since we're talking from Portsmouth, is that you take the great Portsmouth born writer, Charles Dickens, and you take, you know, what I think is the great piece of Christmas fiction, Christmas Carol. Christmas Carol doesn't work unless Scrooge in the first half is an unspeakable, unreasonable man, you know, a man that we dislike intensely. It doesn't work unless he's taken on a trip to see people in the depths of poverty and misery and unhappiness. It doesn't work unless you know that his heart was broken as a young man, and so on. So, in fact, all those dark sides are essential to the resolution of the story at the end, where everything becomes light. But if it's just sweetness and light all the way through, then in in the end, it's like 17 helpings of mince pie and Christmas pudding, and we're all throwing up.
It's really interesting. A character like Scrooge, you know, who I think, you know, there's an acceptance these days that if someone's a Scrooge, they're kind of miserly and against Christmas. Yeah. But actually, Scrooge, the character, is very much, you know, kind of. It's a redemption, isn't
That's
it?
Precisely,
you know, he's
right.
He's a really kind of joyous character at the end of the book.
Yeah, I'd be very happy to end my life as Scrooge ended his, you know, and be thought of like that. It's actually true of White Christmas. You see, we think of the song White Christmas now as a smooth schmaltzy kind of song, but again, it resonated with those people who were apart. And as it happens, the musical structure is very interesting because there are quite a lot of minor chords and sevenths in there, which are not classic. You know, the seventh chords, this takes me on somewhere else. The seventh chords, you know, are the staple diet, if you like, of Black American blues music. You know, now I'm not suggesting White Christmas is a blues song, but I am interested in the question of Black Christmas. I've always been so. And again, if we come back to Christmas adverts this year, among the adverts there are songs by Otis Redding, Edwin Starr and Kool and the Gang. Now, Kool and the Gang are singing Celebration. It's pretty upbeat, it's pretty cheery, but what that does, and they're not explicitly Christmas-themed songs either, but there has been a massive tradition of Black American recordings around Christmas time. And the obvious explanation, and they go way, way back to, you know, to the 1920s, and the tradition was never broken. And the obvious explanation for it is that if you were the oppressed minority, and you go back into the 19th century in the time of slavery and so on, there are very few times in your life when things get easier, things get better, things get celebratory. And Christmas was one of them, where most of the slaves on the plantation were allowed a day of celebration. So it becomes embedded in a culture. And clearly they're not reliving that now. But in the 1960s, which was a period of invention and imagination and new sounds and so on, almost none of the major white acts that actually broke the mold and took popular music forward made special Christmas records. Bob Dylan didn't then, the Beatles didn't, the Rolling Stones didn't, you can't imagine Jimi Hendrix making a Christmas record, you know. I mean, it's hard. Some of those guys have done it since. McCartney, Lennon, even Bob Dylan made a Christmas album. But at the time, everything was so cutting edge, you wouldn't think about it. But even then, the great Black soul acts, Motown, Otis Redding, Al Green, all those people around that time were still making, and you know, quite unselfconsciously, and arguably the greatest pop Christmas album of all time featuring Black artists was the one that Phil Spector produced, you know, with the Ronettes and Darlene Love and so on, and A Christmas Gift for You, which I think has actually just been remastered and it's issued every year, but I think it's been remastered and issued. So that Black tradition just continues. It just goes on and on and on and on, and there are very few major Black musicians that... James Brown did loads of Christmas stuff.
I was saying to you earlier, and I recommend listeners go out and find this on YouTube, the Muppets this year have come out with a song with CeeLo Green called All My Love for Christmas or something like that. And the song itself isn't brilliant, but the video, as you would expect, is, you know, the kind of the real product, which brings me nicely to one of my favourite Christmas films. You know, we were talking about kind of how Christmas is mediated in your experience. Yes. And I love Dickens's Christmas Carol, and to this day I still maintain that the best version of that is the Muppets Christmas Carol. You know, Michael Caine's best performance, I think, as Scrooge. You know, it's kind of, nobody else has quite taken it to that level. Simon, you're grinning there. Is that something you'd agree with?
I do, yeah. I've noticed that the Christmas Carol, the Muppet version, is going to be on locally, isn't it?
It is.
I've been quite tempted to have a look at that over the Christmas period, definitely. Singing about religion tends to be more of an American thing than a UK thing. I don't know if that sounds right to you guys, but it's like, if you take more recent bands like Alabama Shakes from America, you know, they can quite easily kind of dip into this kind of soulful, gospel, religious type kind of scenario. But you don't get many British acts breaking into religious songs. I mean, the band Spiritualized are probably an exception to the rule. They kind of break into that stuff. But there tends to be a tendency to stay away from the religious work. If you want to produce kind of alternative, like indie-type stuff particularly, they tend to stay away from religion.
I mean, that's probably a very good point. Although, funnily enough, actually gospel music has produced very few classic Christmas songs. Go Tell It on the Mountain is one,
yeah.
But there aren't that many, strangely. I think you're probably, on the whole, absolutely correct about that. I think you know, with the exception of, say, Cliff Richard, who has made,
yes,
religious pop hits, you've probably got to go off into the world of folk and traditional music in,
yeah,
Britain, where you do find people. It also takes us, of course, into another question about Christian, about Christmas and Christianity, and we do talk about the essence of Christmas being Christian, but of course in the cultures of Northern Europe, because of the time of year in which we celebrate and so on, its traditions are rooted far beyond Christianity into a kind of, you know, pagan past where, I don't know, you know, Father Christmas coming down the chimney is actually a kind of appropriation of shamanic traditions of shaman who could go up and down, if you like, tubes between different worlds and bring back messages from other worlds. And we've shifted that, the use of mistletoe and holly and so on, which have kind of pagan origins.
I think there's a really interesting question that actually emerges from some of the things that Simon said, in terms of, you know, I find the problem with a lot of Christmas music is it's very nostalgic. It's very kind of, you know, it's kind of saccharine pop a lot of the time. You know, it's kind of like a bit overdone. Is Christmas music a kind of branch of gospel and soul music? Is that kind of where it's ended up? Was it ever kind of folk and blues, or do we perhaps just not notice? You know,
yes, it was folk and blues. I mean, you there are contemporary folk musicians who are doing versions of Holly and the Ivy, for instance, which are not like the version that you would sing traditionally in church. And there is a lot of it. There's a man called John Kirkpatrick, an English folk musician who sings all of that. And the blues tradition, I think helps to answer that question, because in fact, my position would be that Christmas music is not a genre. Genre is defined by style and instrumentation and so on and so on. What Christmas music is a theme that actually works across almost all genres. So there's contemporary pop, there's old blues, there's modern blues, there's soul. Each of those genres. I mean, the other thing that one has to say about this, and of course this all applies to movies as well, is that it very often what we think of as the big Christmas hit has got absolutely nothing to do with Christmas whatsoever, except that it is the big Christmas hit. So for some years, the X Factor single was the big Christmas hit, and I don't follow X Factor religiously, I have to say, but I don't think that the X Factor ever had a big number one at Christmas that was a Christmas, you know, it wasn't like Mary's Boy Child by Harry Belafonte or something. I don't think they ever did that.
In terms of music, there's a famous example, isn't there? Well, there's a number of famous examples, but Johnny Mathis, you know, When a Child is Born, was never really written as a Christmas song. It just happened to hit the chart at the right time, and, you know, kind of he was promoted it and pushed it as a Christmas song once he knew that association kind of stuck.
There was an implication there of a child coming to save the world, so that we could all project onto that our sense of, well, that must be the story of Jesus, but he doesn't mention, yes.
Yeah.
The other song that fascinates me, just before that, because that's a 70s song, but in the 60s, I've said that, you know, there wasn't so much stuff around in the 60s at outside the kind of soul R&B world. One song is Do You Hear What I Hear? Which I have only recently discovered was written in 1962, so it's almost exactly 50 years ago, and it was a kind of antidote to the Cuban Missile Crisis. So it's almost a kind of contemporary political protest song.
Now, I must mention, we're going to talk about kind of our favourite films and favourite songs and bits of music around Christmas. I've got a bit of a strange one, which is my favourite, an album that my wife acquired probably a couple of years ago now, by a band called The Superions, who you've probably never heard of. But behind this project is B-52 frontman Fred Schneider. They made an album called Destination Christmas, which is a joy to behold. Go and have a look at that if you get the chance. There are two songs on it I would recommend. One is Santa's Disco, and the other one is Fruitcake. So if you get a chance to get out there on the internet, it's all there. You can find it on their website or YouTube, all those kind of things. It's just very mad, quite camp, quirky pop, but it works. You know, they're out to have fun, and I think they achieve it. Simon, what about you? What's your favourite Christmas song?
Okay, well, I've got an obvious one, I've got a not-so-obvious one. The obvious one is the Pogues' Fairy Tale of New York. I think that is a lot of people's favourite. And I think there's something about the kind of bah humbug sort of mentality of it. And Christmas is a time to celebrate, but it's also a time when you get a chance to reflect. And sometimes, as this song is kind of illustrating, sometimes leads to bitterness. But I would argue also there's like a touching solidarity between the couple that is in this song. From what I understand, it took quite a while to create. It was over a year or two that they actually went back to the session and refined it and honed it until it became what it is. And then I think a not so obvious one is the comedian Tim Minchin and a song called White Wine in the Sun, which is about, it starts off as kind of like a slightly ironic comedy song about the commercialization of Christmas and that kind of thing, but it proceeds to then go on to being about how he really gets a lot from his family, who he doesn't live with. I believe he's from Australia, and he goes back and takes his daughter to Australia, and the touching moments that happen when they're reunited. I find myself welling up.
Dave, what about you?
Well, I have to say that actually, and I think I would probably have to say the older I get, the more fond I am of quite old choral, traditional, you know, religious Christmas music, and I actually, in our house, we play a lot of that. But I'll stick with the pop stuff, and I'm going to cheat like Simon, really, and nominate two.
Well, that's allowed. It is Christmas.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. One is completely wacky, and I love it to death. It's a guy called Leon Redbone, who's a kind of white ragtime songster who's still around, and he does a duet on he does a whole Christmas album called Christmas Island. He does a duet with Dr. John, the New Orleans pianist, and they do this duet on Frosty the Snowman, and it's just, and you can get it on YouTube with a great video, and it's just crazy and funny, and it makes me laugh, and I love it.
So we'll have to stick that on our blog, I think.
So we'll stick that on the blog. And the other one that I thought you might have mentioned but you didn't is by, I suppose, a kind of relatively cutting edge rock group called Low, who I guess you know about, and they did a sort of mini Christmas EP a few years ago, one track of which is called Just Like Christmas, and I think it's absolutely beautiful. And it's about two people travelling, and they go somewhere, and the guy says, it looked just like Christmas, and she says, but it didn't look like Christmas. And then they get on somewhere else, they end up in Stockholm, and it's snowing, and she suddenly says, and then it was just like Christmas, and it's all kind of slushy and romantic. But they are quite cutting-edge rocky as well, so Lowe's Just Like Christmas would be my other one.
What about films? Let's move on to films, because I've got a fond affection for a particular film, and I've discovered it's not really a Christmas film, but it's kind of cheating. It kind of is and it isn't. I'll explain what I'm talking about. I'm talking about John Hughes's Planes, Trains and Automobiles.
Which is
Steve Martin and John Candy, and it's really a Thanksgiving film. Which, you know, I've tried to ask Americans what Thanksgiving is, and all I can really get from them is it's something to do with the turkey towards the end of November. If you haven't seen the film, it's basically a journey from hell. Two guys come together, really just circumstantially, just trying to get back to their families. There's a really kind of poignant, bittersweet ending, which I won't spoil for you if you haven't seen it.
I'm struggling to think of one that I've enjoyed as an adult, that I've, you know, really, a Christmas film I've really enjoyed. I guess the closest thing is Die Hard. and you pointed this out, Dave, in your article. It's a very strange mix. You know, you've got this action movie that's got, you know, a lot of violence in it, and it's about kidnapping terrorists and all sorts of things. But it has this Christmas backstory to it, and it just works. And it does actually get me in the Christmas mood when I watch it.
I mean, this is not going to amaze anybody, but my favourite Christmas film by a million miles is James Stewart in It's a Wonderful Life, which comes out in 1946. And I love it because, like Scrooge, it's a tale of redemption. You know, it hinges entirely on the idea that a man is going to kill himself on Christmas Eve and he's saved by an angel. And I think that darkness shifting into light is that same theme again that works. My wife and I just watch it, you know, we time it perfectly, and we just watch it every year, and a phone comes off and, you know, the bottle of whatever comes out.
Just before we go, a couple of things you might be interested. If you're at a loose end over the festive period, you can go and see the aforementioned Muppets Christmas Carol at the King's Theatre in Southsea on the 2nd of January at 2 p.m. If you want to aim your sights higher, you can go stargazing at Portsmouth's historic dockyard on the 10th of January at 4 p.m. We're very near the end of the show, but Simon, you've got a lovely Christmas message for everyone.
Well, I think Christmas is very much about family, isn't it? I think it's a thing we all say, it's cliche, but it's very much true. And I personally am looking forward to catching up with my family and enjoying their company, and I hope the listeners do too.
And Dave, you've got something literary to bow out with.
I have Charles Dickens from Portsmouth, God bless him, and this is what he says right at the end of his wonderful story about Scrooge. It was always said of him that he knew how to keep Christmas well if any man alive possessed the knowledge. May that be truly said of us and all of us. And so, as Tiny Tim observed, God bless us, everyone.
Check out more information on our blog, which is towardsthepoint.blogspot.com. You can find some of the videos and links that we've been talking about throughout the programme there. Our thanks to the sellers at Eastney and to our friends at Pine Vinyl. Towards the Point is a King of the Buttons production for 93.7 Express FM.